Here they come. Right now, they're gathering from hospitals all across America for Talk 10 Tuesday. They know there's important news and information just ahead. Don't miss out. Come in, sit down, and log on. It's Talk 10 Tuesday with Chuck Buck and co-host Dr. Erica Reamer. Here now is the publisher of ICD-10 Monitor, Chuck Buck.
Thank you, Clyde Anthony. Hello, everyone, and welcome to the 385th edition of Talk 10 Tuesday, and brought to you today by the American Health Information Management Association, or as we know them, AHIMA. And joining me this morning as my co-host is the very, very popular Dr. Erica Reamer. Dr. Reamer is the founder and the president of Erica Reamer, MD, Incorporated. And good morning, Erica.
Good morning, Chuck, and good morning, everybody.
This morning, our lead story is about the new ICD-10 codes that may or may not be coming to a computer near you.
You're talking about last week's coordination and maintenance meeting.
That's right, I am. It was fall meeting. And although there won't be any immediate decision, Lori Johnson will be reporting on the two-day meeting. And Lori is also going to be reporting on some of the coding issues surrounding vaping.
It's an issue of growing concern. In fact, the topic of addiction will be discussed later in the broadcast by Dr. Nick Vanterhayden.
Indeed. And we have a live report from the AHIMA convention that's taking place in Chicago. Gloria and Brian will be reporting on red flags in coding compliance. And, of course, you have a talkback segment this morning.
Yes, I listened to the ICD-10 coordination and maintenance meeting myself, and I'm going to give you some of my thoughts on it.
Very good. And we have much news to report this morning, and we begin with Tim Powell, who's at the Talk 10 Tuesday News Desk.
The Talk 10 Tuesday News Desk is brought to you by Change Healthcare, providing technology-enabled revenue integrity services to help you improve efficiency, reduce costs, optimize revenue, and more effectively manage complex workflows. Visit changehealthcare.com.
Here now is Tim Powell.
Thanks, Chuck. And Phyllis Formis was sentenced to 20 years in prison for fraud committed in Billings for his assisted living facilities and skilled nursing homes. Prosecutors said that as Formis had overbilled $1 billion to Medicare and Medicaid between 2016 and 2016, and at his sentencing, they estimated the government's loss of more than $550 million and asked the judge to give as Formis 30 years in prison. As Formis lawyers said that the loss was as low as $690,000 and argued for a 10-year sentence. So how can the numbers be so wildly different? Well, it has to do with gross charges, contractual allowances, and base payments. The government took the gross charges of all claims that included inflated or fraudulent charges. The first problem is that Medicare and Medicaid do not pay on gross charges. Medicare payment rates are usually average around $500 per day, and Medicaid rates in Florida run from, say, $190 to as high as $280 a day. Then we get really into the detail. Medicare paid at this time a base rate per day adjusted mostly for the number of physical, occupational, and speech therapy visits. A mix of this would determine the resource utilization group or RUG score used to compute the payment per diem. So let's look at a specific claim and see how all this would work. So here are the specifics. Let's say that I had a patient named John Smith. He was admitted on January 1st of 2010, and he was discharged on January 20th of 2010. He had gross charges of $17,000, and the RUG that was actually paid in this case is an RUX for ultra-high therapy. Now, if they had properly billed the claim, it would have been paid as an RLA, or a low score, rather than an ultra-high. Medicare paid $5,515 on the $17,000 in charges. And if the services have been properly provided or the right amount of services have been provided, Medicare should have paid $1,695. Prosecutors argue the entire $17,000 is the amount of the fraud, even though Medicare only paid $5,515. Attorneys argue the fraud is the amount of the overbilling had the claim been paid properly, or $5,515 less than $1,695 or $3,820. While I can see both perspectives, I doubt Mr. Formis' lavish lifestyle was provided by $690,000 in overbillings. South Florida has historically been the hotbed of healthcare fraud, and there's a long list of other names other than Mr. Formis. Medicare has moved to a new, more complicated reimbursement method called the Patient-Driven Payment Model, or PDPM. I'm actually concerned that the new system could make it harder to catch cheats. The old system was driven by hours of therapy and the number of activities of daily living, or ADLs, that patients required to help. It is easy for auditors to check therapy hours. It's much harder drilling into the much larger number of diagnosis codes driving the new system. In addition, most nursing homes don't maintain good medical records. Nursing homes were not bribed with incentive payments like hospitals and physicians to install electronic medical records. The nursing homes that survive and thrive will start continuous documentation improvement programs and look at documentation at the level of the attending physician to look for poor performers. Welcome to the new world. And with that, back to you, Chuck.
Thanks, Tim, very much. That was Tim Powell. Tim is a compliance expert and an ICD-10 Monitor national correspondent. This is Tuesday, it's September the 17th, 2019, and you're listening to the 385th edition of Talk 10 Tuesday. Stand by.
If you're planning to sit for the Certified Coding Specialist exam, gain added knowledge and test-taking skills with a HEMA CCS exam preparation book. The CCS exam prep contains practice questions and case studies, as well as two full-length practice exams with 291 questions, providing you with comprehensive testing practice to sit for the four-hour exam with confidence. Rationale with updated references, online assessment, and test-taking tips help prepare you for the exam, and they're also included. To purchase, visit my.ahema.org/store.
We now switch live to Chicago, and we check in with Glorianne Bryan, who's been monitoring the National AHEMA Convention. Good morning, Glorianne. What's happening at AHEMA?
Hello, and good morning, everyone, from Chicago and the AHEMA National Conference, which continues through Wednesday of this week. We've had lots of really, really great education surrounding clinical coding and CDI. Both Saturday and Sunday this past weekend were dedicated to those subjects. So we had two full days dedicated there and continue throughout the next few days having afternoon sessions on those topics. And it was a pleasure for me to present on the topic of red flags in coding and risks and compliance. And in this topic, we need to think first about and understand red flags. Those red flags, of course, are warning signs or symbols that we should pay attention to. And they're a way to mark or draw attention to a particular problem or purpose. And they tell us if there's impending danger, disaster, or doom. So you may have heard those when you think of red flags. We've got lots of red flags across healthcare. Often, warning signs are not paid attention to. HIM, coding professionals, CDI professionals, we see things may be wrong or incorrect, but what are we doing? Are we doing the right thing to get corrective action to them? Now, I talked a lot about ICD-10, CM, PCS, and CPT coding red flags, but due to our time this morning, I'm just going to touch on a few things in ICD-10, CM. First, I want to mention healthcare technology within the EHR, and we've seen problems and a red flag around drop-down boxes, to pick or select a diagnosis or a procedure. These drop-down boxes that the provider may be using really first need a verification functionality process. And we also need then a validation by an expert HIM coding professional to validate and confirm the accuracy of those. There's a problem with EHR menus giving options that don't fully describe the code or the description for the reason for the visit, so that can be problematic. There may be something in the functionality of the EHR that makes it leading to a particular diagnosis that's a paying diagnosis versus maybe an unspecified diagnosis that doesn't have a payment directly associated with it. And these EHRs, we have to remember, picking a diagnosis that driving a code often, and I get to see these, include coding conventions, includes, excludes, instructional notes. No, they don't. It's just a pick list. Now, shifting a little bit from that, which we can talk probably more about, I want to talk just briefly about some of the CCMCC red flags we see in the MS-DRG world. The problematic diagnosis around malnutrition as a secondary diagnosis, respiratory failure being a principal or a secondary diagnosis, and of course our beloved sepsis as a principal or secondary diagnosis, pressure ulcers, diabetic complications, those are all problematic. Remember, the OAG has published reports to help us with these red flags, and the conference has lots of other great topics, privacy, security, data analytics. And that's all the time I have for now. Back to you, Erica.
Thanks, Glorianne. That was Glorianne Bryant. Glorianne is a nationally recognized HIM expert, and Glorianne was reporting live from AHIMA's national conference taking place in Chicago.
Our Tuesday focus is on addiction in America. It's a major subject in the national news media. There's a tentative settlement agreement involving Purdue Pharma. They're the makers of OxyContin. And the announcement last week that the White House wants to ban the use of flavors in e-cigarettes in response to a surge in underage vaping. We have two reports. Lori Johnson reports on coding vaping, and Dr. Nick Vander Hayden reports on addiction in America. We begin our Tuesday focus with Dr. Nick Vander Hayden.
130 people die every day from opioid overdoses. To put that in perspective, in the 11 minutes that you've been listening to this episode, one person died, and almost three will die during this radio show. That's about 47,000 people per year, or about the same number of people that commit suicide in the United States. These are shocking numbers. It reminds me very much of the tsunami of challenges that we've seen, and it is ultimately incredibly concerning for ourselves. It's very personal. I think there's hardly anybody in this country that hasn't been touched in it in one form or another. So what made the news? Purdue, who make OxyContin and certainly a central figure that has been implicated in this, is hoping to end their ownership of Purdue and to decline wrongdoings, but in doing so is providing a large sum of money to a number of states who are hopefully going to strike a deal that will fund some of our treatment protocols and practices. So that's good news. I think the approach to this is to address it head on. And the question is, what do we start with? So what are the incremental approaches? So the first thing I'd say is let's stop blamestorming. Let's not blame the patients. Let's not blame the doctors or the caregivers. Let's not blame the community, the police, you name it. This is a universal problem. We have to focus on solutions. And the good news is there are solutions to this, but they need funding. And that's one of the great pieces of news that we've had out of the government and the settlement that's coming from Purdue. So how do we focus on solving this problem? Well, in the first instance, we look for alternatives, non-pharmaceutical treatments of pain. And one of the best versions of that are these alternative methods of stimulation, electrical stimulation. I covered one recently called Buzzy that's used in children who are afraid of needles. It works on the gate theory of pain. And if you want a visual for that, when I was training with a veterinary person who was injecting horses, I asked him how he knew whether the horse was in enduring pain. And he said it was simple. He got kicked. And he used the simple method of tapping the horse's side with his hand and then using the needle. That's essentially what's going on with gait theory. It's an alternative to pharmaceuticals and really making an impression in terms of treating pain without using opioids. There are other things that we can do and certainly other methods. And in fact, Tylenol or acetaminophen, as it's known in its generic form, is a highly effective drug that doesn't come with those addictive properties. But it does have side effects and it is important to monitor it carefully. So we've got lots of answers to this and we have solutions and we've got some funding. That's excellent news. One final thought, think about the drugs that you have in your house and whether you get rid of those appropriately. By the way, don't flush them down the toilets. It's not good for our oceans. It's not good for the sewage system. There are better ways. And in fact, one of the companies we've seen is called DisposeRx. It tracks this and you can put it together and it will seal up that drug. So this is Dr. Nick. I'm the incrementalist. The good news is we are in an incremental path to fixing addiction in America.
Thanks, Dr. Nick. That was Dr. Nick Vander Hayden. Dr. Nick is the founder of Incremental Health. And now to report on the ICD-10 codes for vaping, here is Lori Johnson.
Diseases associated with vaping have been all over the news. In Pittsburgh, there was a teen who vaped for only 18 months. She began experiencing abdominal pain and gastric upset, and after evaluation, she spent 2 weeks in the hospital with severe pulmonary problems. She is still recovering. An Illinois patient died at the end of August after contracting severe respiratory illness. This patient is thought to be the first death related to vaping. There are examples of 450 confirmed and suspected cases in 33 states. The Center for Disease Control, the CDC, is asking the public not to use vaping products while they continue their investigation. The FDA has also published a warning about vaping, especially THC, which is the primary psychoactive ingredient of marijuana. The AMA also supports the banning of flavoring agents in tobacco products, including e-cigarettes. The Surgeon General, supported by the AMA, calls for action regarding increased use of e-cigarettes by young people. Michigan has banned the flavor e-cigarettes, and New York is also considering the same process. President Trump has also called for banning of e-cigarettes. You are at risk if you have vaped in the last 90 days. If you are experiencing symptoms, contact your healthcare provider or call 1-800-222-1222, which is the number for the local poison control center. For coding, lipoid pneumonia is one of the diseases that is associated with vaping and is assigned J69.1. There is a coding instruction to assign a code from T51 to T65 to identify the substance. If the culprit is THC, then the code would be T40.7X, and then there's two digits after that. The sixth digit would indicate the type of poisoning, and the seventh character indicates the episode of care. There is little official guidance related to vaping at the present time. So, Erica, I'll turn it back to you.
Thanks, Lori. That was Lori Johnson. Lori is a member of the ICD-10 Monitor Editorial Board and is a senior healthcare consultant for Revenue Cycle Solutions, LLC. And before that, we heard from Dr. Nick Vanterhaeden, also known as Dr. Nick the Incrementalist. Dr. Nick was speaking on the subject of addiction in America. Thank you both. Chuck?
Thanks, Erica. And thank you very much, Lori Johnson. And you can read Lori's exclusive report on the coding of vaping in today's edition of the ICD-10 Monitor News. And thank you again, Dr. Nick. Dr. Nick is the founder of Incremental Health. Coming up, the aforementioned Lori Johnson reports our lead story on the new ICD-10 codes that may or may not be coming to a computer near you. This is TalkTen Tuesday. Stand by.
Not having an intimate knowledge of modifiers compromises your ability to code properly and to provide needed patient care. But now you can do both thanks to an important webcast coming your way today at 1:30 p.m. Eastern. During this exclusive ICD-10 Monitor webcast, Dr. Jeffrey Lehrman will break down and explain descriptions and examples of some of the most troublesome CPT modifiers. Modifiers that are prone to misuse, auto-denials, and auditor action. The webcast will also include the documentation required to support the use of many of these common modifiers. To register, view the upcoming webcast tab in today's broadcast and save $30 when you enter the coupon code Tuesday.
This morning, our lead story is about ICD-10 codes that may or may not be coming to a computer near you. Last week, CMS conducted the two-day Coordination and Maintenance Committee meeting. Here now with an update on that meeting last week is, once again, Lori Johnson.
The Coordination and Maintenance Committee meeting met on September 10th and 11th to discuss the code proposals. The Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services, CMS, administrates the procedure codes, while the Center for Disease Control, CDC, is responsible for the diagnosis codes. The first half of the day was spent on the procedure codes, and that's day one. The procedure proposals included intraoperative near-infrared fluorescence imaging of a hepatobiliary system using identocyanine green dye, near-infrared spectroscopy for tissue viability assessment, cesium-131 brachytherapy, which would be in addition to the brachytherapies that were added for fiscal year 20, intravascular ultrasound-assisted thrombolysis, administration of neuronidine, administration of aladocogene exuparivec, administration of Zulresso, and Section 8 new technology updates. The presentation on the Section 8 X updates created a lot of discussion, and it appears that the classification is at a crossroads. Section X was created so that the code set could accommodate new technology. These codes may stand alone or be used in conjunction with other PCS codes. CMS must determine how to handle the new technology section. The options include maintain those codes in Section X, after a period of time reassign to the MedSurg section, or delete the codes after the usefulness is over. The CDC led the discussion on diagnosis proposals for the remaining day and a half. CDC brought back the sepsis discussion. There was discussion on sepsis 3 definition, along with a proposal to update CM based on the sepsis 3 definition. The proposal included removal of SIRS, with the exception of SIRS NOS. The 30 other topics presented included fetal anomalies, juvenile osteochondrosis of tibia and fibula, Friedreich ataxia, refractory GERD, and etc. There is a handout that provides information regarding where the CNM materials can be found, as well as the recordings. And in fact, we can chat that information out. One other mention during this meeting was that the original hospital-acquired condition HEC list that was published for version 37 had listed some diagnosis codes that were not appropriate. The HEC list will be updated, and I believe already has. So you want to look at the definition manual for version 37. I have a big ask today, and that is make sure you review the proposals, especially the sepsis and the new technology updates. This profession did a wonderful job in commenting on proposed rule for inpatient prospective payment system. Let's make our thoughts known about the development of ICD-10-CM and ICD-10-PCS. Comments are due by November 8, 2019. And we have to remember that ICD-11 is right around the corner. So back to you, Erica.
Thanks again, Lori. That was Lori Johnson. Lori is a member of the ICD-10 Monitor Editorial Board and is Senior Healthcare Consultant for Revenue Cycle Solutions, LLC. Chuck?
Thanks, Erica. And Lori Johnson, thank you very much for that report on the Coordination and Maintenance Committee meeting. Now's the time for a very popular segment here at Talk In Tuesday, and it's called Talk Back, and it features our own Dr. Erica Reamer. Dr. Reamer, what's on your mind this morning?
Well, I listened to the ICD-10 Coordination Maintenance Committee meeting last week. Hopefully someday I'll actually get to go in person, but for now I only get to do it on the phone, and you guys can do it too. Here are my thoughts, though. There are narrow conditions which are championed for their own codes. So on principle, I support specific diagnoses having unique codes. If you treat patients with Friedreich ataxia, you might want to know what the prevalence is. If a drug or gene therapy is developed which can treat nemaline myopathy, you might want the condition teased out of the group of congenital myopathies so you can link the treatment with the disorder. But I am not sure I really care one way or the other if Powassan virus disease, which had 21 cases in 2018, has its own code. I think that societies and providers who petition for granular codes need to accept that there are large groups of providers who will not take advantage of the granularity, but will fall back on unspecified codes. For instance, the sickle cell code set is being proposed to expand to include sickle cell thalassemia beta 0 and sickle cell thalassemia beta plus. You are not going to get the average emergency physician caring for a patient in pain crisis to take advantage of ICD-10's specificity. Consequently, changing the code set is not going to facilitate tracking patients sorted by sickle cell type who present for pain crisis, for instance. In addition, it irks me when they use non-medical terms. They want to add specificity to site of thoracic injuries, such as right and left anterior thorax. I requested that they use the word midline instead of middle for injuries which are neither right nor left. For the tabular changes, I was ecstatic to see them add non-novel influenza A, influenza B, and influenza C, which I didn't even know existed, as inclusion terms for other identified influenza virus. I thought I didn't support removing peritonitis as an inclusion term for diverticulitis, but on further review, I noted in the instructions that you are supposed to code also the type of peritonitis. So I don't think it will be a problem if perforation and abscess doesn't have peritonitis directly go there. And I think that you should be using additional codes, as many codes as it takes, to make sure that you are describing what's going on with the patient. My final comment on the proposed tabular addenda regards atherosclerosis and adding limb ischemia. I think it is great to add limb ischemia to get to a code, but I am not certain that all providers use the word critical as a mandatory modifier, so they were suggesting that it should be called critical limb ischemia of. Providers will be very irritated if they get queried for that critical word if they document limb ischemia, because to them they think it's just implied and obvious. I think having specificity for etiology of immunodeficiency will be useful. If it's due to taking a long-term medication or adverse effect of a drug, you use an additional code. They are also trying to split out the central nervous system malformations and chromosomal abnormalities, but there is no plan to split out other body systems like cardiac, GU, or musculoskeletal. This actually led to one of the liveliest discussions we had. Having a fetus designation explodes the code set tremendously because there are seventh character for the number of fetuses, for which number fetus is involved. They are considering bringing forth a proposal in the future, divorcing fetus designation from the condition. I suppose they would devise a Z code, like the Z code set for which week of pregnancy a pregnant patient is in. I think the question is, does it matter which fetus has which condition while they are in utero? I'm not an OB or a neonatologist, so I am not sure whether it is critical or not. I think they need more guidance. Sadly, I was at the doctor's with my dad for the sepsis discussion. I think all sepsis circumstances should have an additional code for type of sepsis, including organism, if available. I don't really understand why puerperal sepsis has an excludes one, but sepsis during labor or following abortion has a code first. I also think there should be unspecified viral and fungus sepsis codes. I think this would make SEP1 exclusions easier to determine. And my last point is fentanyl and tramadol are getting their own T codes. Yay! Read the proposals and send in your comments. Back to you, Chuck.
Thanks, Erica, very much. We have asked our panelists to stick around for a roundtable discussion on today's Talk 10 Tuesday, and we do have a question. In fact, we have a number of questions already on this subject of vaping. So, Lori, would you please repeat those vaping codes?
Sure. For the lipoid pneumonia, which is one of the frequently diagnosed conditions that are associated with vaping, it's J69.1, and that's actually in the index. And then for the poisoning code, it's T40.7X. The sixth character is for the type of poisoning, and that would have to be documented by the physician. And the seventh character is for the episode of care.
Thanks very much. That's going to be a wrap for our 385th edition of Talk 10 Tuesday. And I want to thank our panelists today, Gloria Ann Bryant, Lori Johnson, whom you just heard, Tim Powell, Dr. Nick Vander Hayden, and, of course, our co-host, Dr. Erica Reamer. By the way, you can read Lori Johnson's reporting on coding for vaping in today's edition of the ICD-10 Monitor News. And remember, no matter where you are, you can always listen to all the Talk 10 Tuesday podcasts anytime, anywhere, on any device, and it's absolutely free. You can listen to us on Stitcher, on Apple, Spotify, and Google Play. And when you do, rate us. Send us a review. Until next Tuesday, I'm Chuck Buck reporting for ICD-10 Monitor and Talk 10 Tuesday. Thank you so very much for being with us today.
Talk 10 Tuesday is a production of ICD-10 Monitor.